Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with stars, creators, and industry leaders on Broadway and beyond. I'm Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to the one, the only, Audra McDonald. She is the actor who has won the most Tony Awards ever, with 6 trophies to her name, most recently winning for her performance as Billie Holiday in Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill. She's a regular presence on TV, too. She recently wrapped up the 6th and final season of The Good Fight on Paramount Plus, and later this year she'll return for the 2nd season of the HBO series The Gilded Age. Before that, though, she's back on Broadway for the first time since the 2020 shutdown in Ohio State Murders. It's a play that marks the long-awaited Broadway debut of Adrienne Kennedy, the 91-year-old playwright whose unflinching, surrealist, and groundbreaking work is often studied but rarely performed. This interview was recorded just before we knew that Ohio State Murders would be ending its limited run about a month early and closing this Sunday, January 15th. But in our conversation, we talk about why it's been difficult to get audiences to come out for this challenging play, and why some theatergoers are taken aback by McDonald's performance. We also talk about fancy new dressing rooms, the significance of this show inaugurating the newly renamed James Earl Jones Theater, and what it's like when your husband is simultaneously starring as Neil Diamond in his own Broadway show right across the street. Hey, Audra, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Gordon.
So, Ohio State Murders is the Broadway debut of the playwright Adrienne Kennedy, who is one of those writers who is really influential and revered, but she's also someone who is rarely produced, particularly in New York City, enough that you can be like a pretty well-versed theater goer and not really be familiar with her or her work. When did you first encounter this play or her work?
Well, I had heard of her, but I had never studied any of her work. And it was just a name that I knew. I always say that with the caveat of the fact that I did not have a formal sort of theatrical, higher education experience. I went to Juilliard for opera, so I didn't study theater. So I don't know if the Juilliard students in the theater department did there. But the first time I had read any of her work was when Jeffrey Richards and Kenny Leon approached me during the pandemic and asked if I wanted to be a part of a Zoom reading Ohio State Murders for, just for something to do on Zoom, just to sort of bring theater to the masses in whatever way we could during that time. And my agent was like, oh, you need to do this. You need to do this. And that's when I first experienced her work. And I have to tell you, after I did the reading, I got off the Zoom and I just couldn't get it out of my mind. I couldn't get the language out of my mind. And it sort of cracked my heart open and in a very painful, profound way. And so when I got a call, I think 2 days later, saying that they're interested in trying to bring this to Broadway, I was like, count me in.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned that the first reading was over Zoom. It was during the pandemic. And so that was at a time when we were doing a lot of things like that in order to kind of keep theater alive. And then also at the same time, you were sort of co-founding Black Theater United and doing work with that organization as well. And it feels like those two activities are part of the same whole. And I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about how they overlap for you.
How they overlapped was actually kind of interesting. I think George Floyd murder and the creation of Black Theater United and the pandemic and that in those few months as we're rolling into the pandemic, I think that perhaps sort of that time and that awareness and the sort of demand for accountability that was sort of rising up throughout the country and in all sort of businesses and social structures, and you know, and so same thing within our community and theatrical community. I think that may have had something to do with some of the playwrights that that Jeffrey Richards decided to put in this Zoom reading. And so that's part of the Venn diagram right there. Yeah. you know, working with Kenny Leon and then obviously focusing on this incredible playwright who's just who absolutely has there is an awareness of Adrienne, you know, in the academic circles. She's taught in schools. My daughter is in her final year at Brown, and she said, "Oh, Mom, we read Funny House of a Negro last semester." Mm-hmm. You know, and so she, you know, she's getting that education. But just the fact that the commercial world for her has always evaded, you know, Adrienne. I understand her work is challenging. It blows open the idea of what the form of a play can and should be. And she's taking on very, I don't want to say difficult, but, you know, necessary raw material. And she's centering Black women. And for some reason, we seem to have a problem with that. This country, this planet, this industry, really centering Black women and centering their stories and their pain and their triumphs and the idea of who they are, who they can be. I know some people come to see Ohio State Murders and they're a little taken aback by like how I'm speaking or the words that I'm using. And it's like, yes, Black women exist in all forms and all facets of society in all different ways they exist. And Adrienne is, you know, is bringing all that to center. And some people have a problem with it. And I don't think I'm answering your question very well, Gordon.
Well, you are actually, is that it's the greater awareness, as you said, sort of fueled Jeffrey Richards' choice, the producer Jeffrey Richards' choice to,
yes,
to do it.
And yes. And then, and then honestly, for me, it fueled my choice when they said, we would like to bring this to Broadway. It was like, well, yes, absolutely. And then the last, you know, piece of the puzzle to fall in place was the fact that we, you know, at Black Theater United and other organizations, you know, one of the ways in talking about accountability and awareness and action is, you know, creating a theatrical community where we can see ourselves as well. And that's not just on stage, but like in the brick and mortar. And so to have, you know, this sort of the New Deal, the Broadway's New Deal that BTU struck with many leaders in the Broadway community. And one of those things, one of the tenets, one of the things that we said we needed to see start to happen was to have theaters named for Black artists so that, you know, we can, so that the theater tells us that, yes, we belong here as well. So much so that here we are in brick and mortar. And so to have it, you know, our play be at the James Earl Jones Theater and be the inaugural production of the James Earl Jones Theater. Adrienne and James Earl Jones know each other. Mm. In fact, I think Adrienne said they had a conversation just recently. Mm. It just all felt like kismet, and it all sort of felt like definitely, you know, all landed in the middle of that sweet spot in the Venn diagram of how this all came to be.
Yeah. How do you tell people what it's about when they ask you?
You know, sometimes it depends on who I'm talking to.
I bet.
And that's the honest answer. Yeah. Because I want people to come and see it. And so if you say, you know, it's a play about, you know, murder and systemic racism as it affects a young Black woman in the late 40s and how it affects her to this day or 1992, right. A lot of people are going to run from that. Yeah. They'll be like, So sometimes I'll say it's a murder mystery about, you know, something that happened in the past that someone is now speaking about that they experienced and they're telling that story. And then sometimes I'll say it's, you know, it's centering a Black woman's experience of racism in higher education in the 40s, 3 years after Ohio State's dorms were desegregated, right. You know, but you know, I pick and choose who I say that to.
Yeah.
Again, with the purpose of, wanting as many people to see it, because once people come and they see it, you know, then they understand how important the story is and how necessary it is to tell these stories. Yeah. There's a cautionary tale too, I think.
What is it that you mentioned that some people are surprised by the way your character speaks in this play? What is it that you find surprises them?
Well, in the same way that certain people are like, you know, I'm doing the Gilded Age and people are like, oh, well, yes, they're just trying to be woke. They're just trying to, you know, sure, okay, Black people that had businesses and whatnot in New York City and the Gilded Age, okay, whatever. It's like, no, actually existed, actual historical fact. So there's an ignorance about the fact that, you know, and there's prejudice and there's stereotyping of Black people and how people want to see and hear from them in their theater. You know, they want to see and hear from them in a certain way. Well, you know, I want you dancing and singing, or I want you, you know, if you're going to be, you know, doing a play, it's gotta be Raisin in the Sun, or, you know, it's like, no. There are all types of us and they're in all different aspects of life and in all different sort of levels of education. And so the fact that this, and I am choosing the way I speak in the show very deliberately to mirror Adrian as much as possible, because this is a semi-autobiographical story. And Suzanne Alexander, you know, there are the four Alexander plays as well as letters to my students. This sort of, it's like sort of an avatar for Adrian. And so, because we were, you know, presenting her Broadway debut, Kenny and I really wanted to make sure that we were bringing as much of Adrian to this experience as possible. And so that means not only the actual play, but the interviews you hear of Adrian before the show begins, and then afterwards. We want people to walk out of the theater wanting to know more about her. And I wanted to bring her into my Suzanne. Her Suzanne as much as possible. And because I've gotten this wonderful experience of being able to talk to her, you know, usually on a weekly basis, she emails me every day. You know, we've been having conversations since July of 2022. Mm-hmm. So I've had a lot of time to spend with her and hear her voice and hear her cadences. And I'm not the first one to do this. When she did this, when the premiere happened with Ruby Dee, and she had first approached Ruby Dee and asked her if she wanted to do this play. Ruby came to her apartment, bounded up the stairs. And one of the first things she said is, I want you to read the play to me. Wow. I want to hear you say it. Yeah. It's such a specific, there's such a specific poetry and rhythm. And I think I was fully able to understand it once I heard Adrian speak.
Yeah. I've heard you say that you, one of the reasons you wanted to do this show was that it scared you. Can you tell us a little bit about what's scary about it?
What's not scary about this show? I mean, first and foremost, there is the language, which is incredible and beautiful. And there's prose there's poetry from time to time, but the sheer volume of it, the fact that it's a memory play, and the fact that there's, I think the script has about 30 pages, and about 28.8 of those pages are all Suzanne's lines. So, but because Suzanne is, I tell people this is harder than Lady Day for me. And it is, because at least Lady Day, there were moments where I could relax in the singing. You know, the songs would break up the monologue that, that Billy, and it was a slow moving car wreck. And Billy was at the end of her life. And so she wasn't vibrating on a very high level anymore. And so she's starting here, and it's just, that's what's happening. But Suzanne is sitting on this whole story, and she's trying to get it out without falling apart, so that she can deliver the indictment, so that she can deliver the truth, so that she can finally release her daughters and make her daughters known publicly, say their names, all of that. So she's sitting on it. So Suzanne is vibrating here. And that's a much more taxing place to be, I think, in some ways, emotionally. And then the subject matter, I have two daughters, I'm a mother. And so the subject matter is very, very painful. Not that Billy's wasn't. So it's just it's the hardest thing I've ever done. All that adds up to the hardest thing I've ever done, but it's only an hour and 15 minutes. So
yeah.
Cause it couldn't be.
And I think that's probably
you,
true.
You just,
Yeah.
I'll have more with Audra right after the break. Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. And now, here's more with Audra McDonald.
In other productions of the show, there are two Suzannes. There's an older Suzanne and a younger Suzanne. In other productions, they have been played by two separate actors, and you are playing both roles in this. Was that always going to be the choice? And why was that important to you, do you think?
Well, obviously that was the choice when we did the Zoom reading, because there was, you know, no need to really have another actor. We were just sitting in our little apartments on Zoom. But Kinney and I talked about it, and, you know, we had Adrian's blessing to do it. It's not like he went rogue and just said, you know, we're going to do this. Good luck. You know, but so that Suzanne, so that older Suzanne is an active participant in her memory instead of just watching and narrating what's happening. I think as an actress, it was able, because I'm playing both old and young Suzanne, I'm reliving the memory physically, physiologically, psychologically. I'm actually reliving it as opposed to watching a younger actress relive it and then comment on it. There's something that feels, it's a more visceral experience for the actress. So maybe that was selfish of me to say, you know, but, there's been all kinds of different productions of Ohio State Murders where different characters have been played by the same actor, not Suzanne, as far as I know, but, and then sometimes we've seen Suzanne's father, I think, you know, whereas in our production, you don't. I think the very first production, you might have seen Suzanne's father. And it's been varied how all those other parts are played and portrayed. And sometimes it's one actor, sometimes it's three or four, I think, depending on production and budget and whatnot. But it just seemed like the right thing to try here. Yeah. And Adrian seems happy for us to experiment.
Yeah. You talked a little bit already about kind of capturing her voice and kind of bringing her voice to the stage. And I feel like not unlike what you did with Lady Day, you're doing something very specific with your voice. And even, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like you're doing something a little different for the younger Suzanne than older Suzanne. And I just wonder, thinking about, as you said, you trained in opera and you have a big background in sort of training your voice. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how that training informs the kind of stuff you can do with your voice when you are singing or not.
Well, I mean, I think it comes down to having a really good voice teacher. Mm-hmm. And I've been with the same voice teacher since masterclass in 95. So I first found this voice teacher. And so this is not necessarily something I found at Juilliard, but shortly after leaving Juilliard. And this particular teacher has taught me to incorporate my voice as all being one thing. And so for him, it's about the health of the voice. And then you can ask it to do the things that you need to do as long as there is sort of like a singular sort of centered, like central command system of the voice, if that makes sense at all. It probably doesn't. Uh-huh. But in terms of that, it's always going to me bringing my full body and full voice to everything I do. And then I tailor it to what is needed. But finding a healthy way to do it, that's the most important thing. So like even with Billie Holiday, I was still having lessons with him while I was doing Billie Holiday. Yeah. And this is the same man that trained me to do, the Lady M's aria in masterclass as well. So it's the same warm-ups. It's all the same thing. It's about incorporating the entire body. And then as far as finding the specificity within the sound, that requires for me just a lot of listening. So like most of my conversations with Adrian, I've recorded so that I can, and I listen to her every night. And now because Kenny has added her voice to the top of the show, that's sort of the work being done for me in that way as well.
And you've also mentioned the fact that you had her around during the whole rehearsal process, and working with a living playwright, I'm sure in there's some version of that can be quite frustrating as new pages are coming in and all that stuff. But I imagine, particularly with a play like Ohio State Murders, having the actual authority there must have been hugely helpful. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, it's been incredible. I mean, I don't know how I would have done this or understood this play if I hadn't had her there, as well as I think I understand it, and I'm still discovering every night. But even just in questions I can ask her, what does this mean when she says she meditates on the repetitive phrases? Where does that come from in your life? Mm. And she's like, because sometimes I would just like to daydream. And I would daydream about these things. Or I would, hear certain words and I just would want to say them over and over again to sort of discover what the meaning was or how I could make it mean all these different things. So even just moments like that, whereas if you didn't have if you didn't have Adrian, you'd have someone who's saying, well, I've read everything Adrian Kennedy's ever done and I've studied all her work. And what she meant was there, which is lovely. And that's important too. But there's something so incredible about having the oracle right there, having it's like people talk about source, going to source. Mm. Source is right there. I think it's okay to say this. Maybe it's not, I don't know. But one of the people that she talks about in the play, one of the girls that bullied her and antagonized her, the head of the group of girls that antagonized her, the white girls that did, was a real person. And I was able to get like specific information about this real person and how she antagonized Adrian and how she made her feel horrible and the ways in which she did it and what she was wearing and all of that. I've been able to just get every little, it's like, I feel like I have a coloring, I have a box of crayons and I've got 75,000 colors because I'm getting all the little bits and pieces of information right from her. Yeah. And so it helps me to sort of layer as much as I possibly can.
Yeah. Yeah. As you mentioned, it's a short show. It's also pretty brutal. How do you, I guess, first of all, sustain yourself through it 8 times a week? And then how do you, you have to leave it at the theater if you're going to, you know, have any sanity left. What is your ritual for that?
It's the ritual is getting here 2 hours before, at least, 2 hours before call.
Right.
The call is half hour before the show. So I get here. So that's 2.5 hours before the show actually starts. And really settling in and letting Suzanne's sort of thoughts and world take over. And then and every night when they call places, Gordon, it is so hard to walk on that stage. I have to tell myself, I get to the edge of where my door is before I walk into the hallway, then go up the stairs to the stage. And I get to the edge of the door of my dressing room and I always stop and I'm like, I know what's about to happen. I have to tell myself, put your right foot in front of your left foot and walk, because it's such a heavy lift. Yeah. And what I have to tell myself is just tell the story, and as Lonnie Price, my great friend and great director, says to me, slice the bread one slice at a time. You can't slice the whole loaf at once. You can't hike up a mountain like by leaping to it. You have to put that first foot down. And so all I can tell myself is just put the right foot in front of your left and continue to walk on stage. And now all you got to do is get to the stage. Okay, you did that. Now all you got to, and it has to be like that. And then otherwise you'd never go,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right, you'd never go. And then at the end of the show, I have to say goodbye. I have to make it a point to say goodbye to Suzanne in the dressing room, mm-hmm. and say, thank you. And I honor you. And I will be back tomorrow to tell your story again, mm-hmm. but you have to stay here. You can't come home with me. Yeah. You know, I had to do that with Billie Holiday mm-hmm. too. And then working on Frankie and Johnny mm-hmm. with our intimacy coordinator and choreographer, also help to kind of solidify that it's tapping in and tapping out and saying, okay, this is all very real in this moment right here on stage. And now you tap out and say, okay, now it's my life that I'm taking home with me and not this. Yeah. That's the sanity.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of your life away from the theater, by total coincidence, your husband, Will Swenson, also an actor, is also starring in his show right across the way at exactly, open something like 4 days apart or something like that, right?
Yeah. 4 days apart. Right. Crazy.
Which sounds, I imagine at first blush, I mean, for people maybe who don't know quite how, what the run up to an opening night is like it sounds, oh, that sounds fun, but I bet more. I bet it was chaos is what it probably was.
It was such chaos. And I also had Carnegie Hall on the 3rd. His opening on the 4th of December, and then my opening on the 8th of December. Yeah. So we were both were rehearsing at the same time in previews at the same time. And for people who don't understand, previews means you're still rehearsing during the day and doing the show at night. So you have like no life. It was chaos. It's still chaos. It's calming down a little bit. And we always knew that my run was a short run. Right. So that's what he's going to be in those sparkly boots and sequins for quite a while, and that's not the case with me. So we always knew that it was going to be a rough, compact time where we were both going at it. But I think because we've been together for so long now, we've been together about 15 years, and we've been raising children together. Now we've got the 3 older ones and we have our 6-year-old. So it's just about understanding who needs what. And there have been times it's like, well, we both need sleep. Yeah. And we literally, narrowed it down to, well, if you can't sing Neil, you can't do Neil.
Right.
If I'm feeling a little like hoarse, I could still get through my, hour and 15 minutes or 10 minutes, whatever it is of speaking. Will can't do it. So I've been sacrificing my sleep and getting up with our daughter and getting her off to school at 6 a.m. so that he can sleep in, so that he can do his show. And we both like, I'll go over to his theater, or we have usually have lunch in between shows together now, which has been nice. And, you know, it's never anything big. It's just, you know, sitting kind of staring at the wall. Yeah, I brought you some chicken. Yeah. Both of us just sort of like, do you want to take a nap? And then just sort of dozing off for a second. It's like, all right, see ya. And then meeting him after the show. But there's a great understanding right now, and always has been, but especially right now, there's just an appreciation for what we both do and understand that we're both going through it at the same time. So you have kind of a partner in crime, and you have an empathetic partner who's also dealing with the same thing. So, but we're very lucky too. I'm not complaining.
Of course.
We wouldn't have. You know, our daughter, our 6-year-old, is the one who hates it the most right now. But
yeah, both parents. Both parents are pretty busy right
now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's hard. That's hard when you're six.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And so, in addition to the theater, as you mentioned, Ohio State Murders is a limited run. We see you on TV pretty regularly. You've recently wrapped up your last season, the final season of The Good Fight. And then coming up will be Gilded Age, as you mentioned. What else is on your plate? What's coming up next for you?
Well, there's a couple things there that I'm not allowed to talk about right now, but you know, for me, touch wood. There's no wood.
There's no wood in the dressing room with the Jones. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a new theater. So it's all the new materials. The universe has always brought me what I needed. Mm-hmm. At the right time. I mean, I'm going to be doing a lot of concertizing this coming year, but I don't ever want to just focus on one thing. And maybe that's, you know, I've always been sort of, you know, I've had ADHD and ADD as a child, and, you know, hyperactive in terms of like squirrel. But especially when it comes to performing, but all of it feeds everything else for me. You know, when I do work in the theater, that then feeds and informs film work or television work, that informs, or I feel that I'm able to evolve as a TV actor or a film actor when I'm doing theater. And then, like, if I'm doing film work or television work, that then sort of can feed and inform the theater work or concertizing work. All of it sort of informs the other for me, and it's a part of my sort of main goal, which has always been just to evolve as an artist. And so I don't say no to any one aspect of my career, because I want to continue to evolve in all aspects of it. So there's another non-answer.
Great.
For you.
Great. Is there anything we should look out for from BTU in the coming months?
Well, I have handed over the presidency of BTU now to the great LaChance. Yep. And yes, there's always great stuff on the horizon with BTU right now. We're really just trying to make sure that the implementation of the New Deal continues, and there are regular meetings and committee meetings with the all the signatories of the Broadway's New Deal on a regular basis to make sure that we're continuing to evolve with that work, and it's a living, breathing document as well. You know, and a lot of that right now, we're looking at what's happening, just sort of like with, you know, like you think about what happened with Ain't No Mo and other shows, that it's like there's still a lot of work to be done, not only in getting these shows to Broadway, but then helping them to sustain, you know, their time on Broadway as well. And that means, you know, cultivating the audiences, making Broadway more accessible financially. Also, I've been speaking out a little bit about this. I think it's important to make sure that, you know, we bring these shows, you know, so we're telling lots of different stories, but it's not just cultivating a diverse audience. You have to do that too, but then you have to entice the regular, I don't want to say regular, that's the wrong word too, but, you know, for lack of a better word, the white audience, the white theater goer, to come see these shows as well. You know, yes, it's important to support, you know, the good old fashioned musicals and the, you know, the things that are not necessarily centering the Black experience or the Asian experience or any of the BIPOC experience. Mm-hmm. But now you need to come and support that as well. You know, there's good theater to be had all around. And so I think that's an important part of the puzzle as well.
As you mentioned, you are the first show in the James Earl Jones Theater. And the first time I was there, there's kind of that side lobby where the restrooms are. And it was so nice that I was like, am I actually in the wrong place? Like, this is, you know, Broadway theaters are, you know, a little older. Yeah, exactly. So you're in the dressing room right now. How is it? Is it as glamorous as the lobby out there?
It's lovely. It's absolutely lovely. I'm in a completely accessible.
I was just going to ask about that. Yeah,
which is miraculous, with accessible bathrooms, accessible doors, all of that. It's incredible. There's, you know, you can plug in your HDMI sort of cables as well as your all that stuff. It's all the modern conveniences. But because I've been doing Broadway since 1992, I walked in. I was like, this is beautiful. It's so clean. It feels wrong. Do you know what I mean? I was like, there's nothing dirty. There's not old couches from the 1950s that are still floating from dressing room to dressing room, or like, you know, a couple of cabaret chairs. There's always like 400 assorted brown and Black cabaret chairs in every theater, you know. So there was a part of me that had to get used to it being so clean. When I tour and do lots of concert halls all over the place, the backstage areas, especially the newer concert halls, look like this. So it's just weird for me to be here and be like, okay, right, I'm in a Broadway house, because it's so nice. That's the thing. Like, so it's like, you know, I'm a creature of also the 90s in New York. Right. I'm like, I kind of miss, you know, the Loves drugstores and the, you know, all the mom and pop shops. And so, but having said that, it's gorgeous. It's clean. It's beautiful. It's accessible. And that's incredible.
Good. Well, enjoy that dressing room and break a leg with the show tonight. Thanks so much, Otto. It was great talking to you. Thank you.
Likewise, Gordon. Take care.
That was Audra McDonald, now on Broadway in Ohio State Murders at the James Earl Jones Theater through January 15th. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, I'd really appreciate it if you took the time to rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. It really does help us grow our audience of folks who love theater as much as you and I do. Or tell a friend about Stagecraft. Find past episodes and subscribe at all the pod purveyors, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and on the Broadway Podcast Network, which is a great place to find more theater for your ears. Until next episode, find me on Twitter at @GCoxVariety. Thanks for listening, and see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.